From the Journal of Xavier Desmond. March 21st. En route to Seoul. A face out of my past confronted me in Tokyo, and it has preyed on my mind ever since. 2 days ago, I decided that I would ignore him and the issues raised by his presence, that I would make no mention of him in this journal. I've made plans to have this volume to be offered for publication after my death. I do not expect a bestseller, but I would think the number of celebrities aboard the stacked deck and the various newsworthy events we've generated will stir up at least a little interest in the great American public, so my volume may find its own audience. Whatever modest royalties it earns will be welcomed by the JADL to which I've willed my entire estate. Yet, even though I'll be safely dead and buried before anyone reads these words, and therefore in no position to be harmed by any personal admissions I might make, I find myself reluctant to write to Fortunato. Call it cowardice, if you will. Jokers are notorious cowards if one listens to the jests, the cruel sort that they do not allow on television. I can easily justify my decision to say nothing of Fortunato. My dealings with him over the years have been private matters, having little to do with politics or world affairs or the issues that I've tried to address in this journal, and nothing at all to do with this tour. Yet, I have felt free in these pages to repeat the gossip that has inevitably swirled around the airplane, to report on the various foibles and indiscretions of Dr. Tachyon and Peregrine and Jack Braun and Digger Downs and all the rest. Can I truly pretend that their weaknesses are of public interest and my own are not? Perhaps I could. The public has always been fascinated by aces and repelled by jokers. But I will not. I want this journal to be an honest one, a true one. And I want the readers to understand a little of what it has been like to live 40 years a joker. And to do that, I must talk of Fortunato, no matter how deeply it may shame me. Fortunato now lives in Japan. He helped Hiram in some obscure way after Hiram had suddenly and quite mysteriously left the tour in Tokyo. I don't pretend to know the details of that. It was all carefully hushed up. Hiram seemed almost himself when he returned to us in Calcutta, but he has deteriorated rapidly again, and he looks worse every day. He has become volatile and unpleasant and secretive. This is not about Hiram, of whose woes I know nothing. The point is, Fortunato was embroiled in the business somehow and came to our hotel, where I spoke to him briefly in the corridor. That was all there was to it. Now, but in years past, Fortunato and I have had other dealings. Forgive me. This is hard. I'm an old man and a joker, and age and deformity alike have made me sensitive. My dignity is all I have left, and I am about to surrender it. I was writing about self-loathing. This is a time for hard truths, and the first of those is that many gnats are disgusted by jokers. Some of these are bigots, always ready to hate anything different. In that regard, we jokers are no different from any other oppressed minority. We are all hated with the same honest venom by those predisposed to hate. There are other normals, however, who are more predisposed to tolerance, who try to see beyond the surface to the human being beneath. People of good will, not haters. Well-meaning, generous people like Dr. Tachyon and Hiram Worcester, to choose two examples close to hand. Both of these gentlemen have proven over the years that they care deeply about jokers in the abstract. Hiram, through his anonymous charities, Tachyon, through his work at the clinic. And yet both of them, I am convinced, are just as sickened by the simple physical deformity of most jokers as the Nur al-Allah or Leo Barnett. You can see it in their eyes, no matter how nonchalant and cosmopolitan they strive to be. Some of their best friends are jokers, but they wouldn't want their sister to marry one. This is the first unspeakable truth of jokerhood. How easy it would be to rail against this, to condemn men like Tack and Hiram for hypocrisy and formism, a hideous word coined by a particularly moronic joker activist and taken up by Tom Miller's Jokers for a Just Society in their heyday. Easy and wrong. They are decent men, but still only men, and cannot be thought less because they have normal human feelings. Because, you see, the second unspeakable truth of jokerhood is that no matter how much jokers offend gnats, we offend ourselves even more. Self-loathing is the particular psychological pestilence of Jokertown, a disease that is often fatal. The leading cause of death among jokers under the age of 50 is, and always has been, suicide. This, despite the fact that virtually every disease known to man is more serious when contracted by a joker because our body chemistries and very shapes vary so wildly and unpredictably that no course of treatment is truly safe. In Jokertown, you'll search long and hard before you'll find a place to buy a mirror. But there are mask shops on every block. If that was not proof enough, consider the issue of names. Nicknames, they call them. They're more than that. They are spotlights on the true depths of Joker self-loathing. If this journal is to be published, I intend to insist that it be titled The Journal of Xavier Desmond, not a Joker's Journal or any such variant. I am a man, a particular man, not just a generic Joker. Names are important. They are more than just words. They shape and color the things they name. The feminists realized this long ago, but jokers still have not grasped it. I have made it a point over the years to answer to no name but my own. Yet, I know a joker dentist who calls himself Fishface, an accomplished ragtime pianist who answers to Catbox, and a brilliant joker mathematician who signs his papers Slimer. Even on this tour, I find myself accompanied by three people named Chrysalis, Troll, and Father Squid. We are, of course, not the first minority to experience this particular form of oppression. Certainly black people have been there. Entire generations were raised with the belief that the prettiest black girls were the ones with the lightest skins whose features most closely approximated the Caucasian ideal. Finally, some of them saw through that lie and proclaimed that black was beautiful. From time to time, various well-meaning but foolish jokers have attempted to do the same thing. Freakers, one of the more debauched institutions of Jokertown, has what it calls a Twisted Miss contest every year on Valentine's Day. However sincere or cynical these efforts are, they are surely misguided. Our friends, the Dickesians, took care of that by putting a clever little twist on the prank they played on us. The problem is, every Joker is unique. Even before my transformation, I was never a handsome man. Even after the change, I am by no means hideous. My nose is a trunk, about 2 feet long, with fingers at its end. My experience has been that most people get used to the way I look if they're around me for a few days. I like to tell myself that after a week or so, you scarcely notice that I'm any different, and maybe there's even a grain of truth in that. If the virus had only been so kind as to give all Jokers trunks where their noses had been, the adjustment might have been a good deal easier, and a Trunks Are Beautiful campaign might have done some real good. But, to the best of my knowledge, I am the only Joker with a trunk. I might work very hard to disregard the aesthetics of the Nat culture I live in to convince myself that I am one handsome devil, and that the rest of them are the funny-looking ones. But none of that will help the next time I find that pathetic creature they call Snotman sleeping in the dumpster behind the funhouse. The horrible reality is, my stomach is as thoroughly turned by the more extreme cases of Joker deformity as I imagine Dr. Tachyon's must be. But if anything, I am even more guilty about it. Which brings me, in a roundabout way, back to Fortunato. Fortunato is, or was at least, a procurer. He ran a high-priced call girl ring. All of his girls were exquisite, beautiful, sensual, skilled in every erotic art, and by and large pleasant people, as much a delight out of bed as in it. He called them geishas. For more than 2 decades, I was one of his best customers. I believe he did a lot of business in Jokertown. I know for a fact that Chrysalis often trades information for sex upstairs in her crystal palace whenever a man who needs her services happens to strike her fancy. I know a handful of truly wealthy Jokers, none of whom are married, but almost all of whom have Nat mistresses. The hometown papers we've seen tell us that the five families and the Shadow Fists are warring in the streets, and I know why. Because in Jokertown, prostitution is big business, along with drugs and gambling. The first thing a Joker loses is his sexuality. Some lose it totally, becoming incapable or asexual. But even those whose genitalia and sexual drives remain unaffected by the wild card find themselves bereft of sexual identity. From the instant one stabilizes, one is no longer a man or a woman, only a Joker. A normal sex drive, abnormal self-loathing, and a yearning for the thing that's been lost, manhood, femininity, beauty, whatever. They are common demons in Jokertown, and I know them well. The onset of my cancer and the chemotherapy have combined to kill all my interest in sex. But my memories and my shame remain intact. It shames me to be reminded of Fortunato. Not because I patronized a prostitute or broke their silly laws. I have contempt for those laws. It shames me because, try as I did over the years, I could never find it in me to desire a Joker woman. I knew several who were worthy of love. Kind, gentle, caring women who needed commitment and tenderness and, yes, sex as much as I did. Some of them became my cherished friends. Yet, I could never respond to them sexually. They remained as unattractive in my eyes as I must have been in theirs. So it goes in Jokertown. The seatbelt light has just come on, and I'm not feeling very well at present, so I will sign off here.
Always Spring in Prague by Carrie Vaughan. Read for you by Donabella Mortel. April 1987. The delegates were settled in their hotel rooms. The security check of the building and surrounding streets was done, and scare agent Joanne Jefferson gave herself a moment to pause on the balcony of one of the upper suites to gaze over the vista of Prague and simply enjoy the view. The hotel was on the south bank of the Vltava River, with a good view of the Charles Bridge, a Renaissance construction lined with statues that stood like ghostly pilgrims, and the fortress complex on the hill across the steel-gray water. The city skyline was unique, identifiably European and medieval, but with exotic, otherworldly touches. Churches with strange, jutting spires, Baroque domes, jagged rooflines, and romantic Art Nouveau facades, the gilded remnants of last century's optimism, butting up against neighborhoods with tangled, narrow streets. The communist city seemed tired, but the hints of what it had been, one of the great cultural capitals of Europe, managed to peer through the gray. Afternoon sunlight made the walls and spires of the castle on the hill glow. Here she was, seeing the world, a dream come true. The irony was that after 5 months on the road with the WHO tour, Joanne was going to need a serious vacation. Back in the hallway, on the way to the room that was serving as ops for the tour, she ran into Billy Ray, who'd completed his own security sweep. He made a show of being a professional tough guy, with his white fighting suit and broken, oddly mended face that gave him a constant glowering expression. But he was a conscientious agent. They'd been working together for years now.
"How's it look?"
he asked. "Fine. Calm. I think everyone's getting worn out."
"Wouldn't that be nice? Get everyone to stay in their rooms and out of trouble for once?"
He crossed his arms and huffed, as if demonstrating how unlikely that was with this bunch. "That's no way to get your picture in the paper now, is it?" she said, and Ray chuckled. He glanced at her sidelong while leaving most of the space of the hallway open between them. Most people who knew her did so. She was used to keeping a good distance between herself and others, but Ray often gave her this look like he was sizing her up, wondering how much of his super strength and healing could stand up to her life-draining power. She settled her black and silver cloak more firmly around her, kept her head bowed and hidden under the hood, aware that she presented an image of herself as dangerous and mysterious that she didn't always appreciate. But the cloak helped her control her power, preventing it from lashing out to leech the energy from everything, everyone around her. She hadn't touched another living soul, except to do damage to them, since she was a child. He added,
"You might keep your eyes open. A couple of spooks are holed up in the building across the street. Standard spy versus spy shit. They may get pushy."
"They'd probably learn more about the tour by reading the newspapers than running surveillance."
"Yeah. I'll take the first shift on call if you want to get some rest."
"Thanks, I will," she said, and he waved her off as he marched on to ops. The security contingent and staff on the tour didn't get the luxury suites that the delegates did. But this was still a 5-star hotel, and Joanne was more than happy with her plain room, with its king bed, private bathroom, and clawfoot tub. She was contemplating the extravagance of a hot bath when she got a call on her room's phone. "Lady Black, this is Representative Kramer. May I have a word with you?" "Yes, Representative, of course. Is there a problem?" Inwardly, she groaned. If they had a problem, the delegates shouldn't be calling her. They should be calling ops. Unless this was for something unofficial. Unofficial and complicated, of course. "I would very much like to discuss this in person, if possible." She worded it as a request, but the tone of command was unmistakable. So much for a bath. Joanne took a wistful look back at the expansive bed and bade farewell to an afternoon nap. Congresswoman Carol Kramer, Republican from Missouri, was one of those accidental women politicians who stepped into the opening left when her husband died. In this case, he dropped dead of a heart attack during a re-election campaign. She won the election for his seat 3 years ago, won re-election for herself, and seemed to be digging in for a long political career. As the most junior political delegate on the tour, she'd kept a very low profile. Her main goal seemed to be to do her duty in representing the Republican Party on the tour, while avoiding any kind of scandal that might damage her future political aspirations, which made calling for a secret conference with a scare security agent all the more surprising. Joanne reassured herself. How much trouble could a polite Southern Midwestern lady like Carol Kramer really get into? Kramer was watching for her and opened the doorway wide when Joanne arrived at her room. Joanne declined the offered chair and prepared to listen attentively. Kramer paced. She was in her 50s, very well dressed in a tailored, light blue dress suit. Her short, ash-colored hair curled and settled. She was the kind of woman who'd never leave her room without checking to make sure her clothing, hair, makeup, everything were perfect. I have, well, a favor to ask. But I'd like it to be kept quiet if at all possible. It's nothing illegal, I'm certain, but it's sensitive. Lady Black, I need you to find someone. Joanne raised an eyebrow and waited for further explanation. I have friends. Political donors, really, which is why I'd like to keep this quiet. They have a daughter, 20 years old, who dropped out of Smith earlier this year and then all but vanished. The family has considerable resources, of course, and they hired investigators, but they've only made a little progress. They believe she's here in Prague, and they've asked me to confirm that and to talk to her if I can. She drew a battered envelope out of the desk drawer. Tipping it open, she slid out a handful of photographs and a typed report. Joanne stepped over to look. The daughter, Katrina Dubas, according to the label, was a joker. In place of her left arm, a collection of orange, snake-like limbs clustered, Medusa-like. They seemed prehensile, wrapping around the arm of the lawn chair where she sat. The bright, shimmering orange scales from this strange limb continued upward to her neck and partially covered her cheek, giving the impression that she wore a partial mask. The photo was a candid snapshot, taken at some backyard party. In the background, a group of college-aged kids were playing frisbee. Dressed in a tank top and flowing skirt, she held a can of Coke in her normal hand and rolled her eyes as if the person with the camera had asked her to pose. The young woman seemed shy, but not ashamed. Not trying to hide from the camera, not trying to disguise her deformity. She had lively brown eyes. She's a joker, Joanne observed, stating the obvious. Kramer closed her eyes and sighed, as if it was a tragedy. Yes, that happened only a couple of years ago. She became infected and was ill for quite a long time, and I'm afraid things just haven't been the same for the family since. I imagine not, Joanne said wryly. If she had to judge from the photo, Katrina seemed at ease. Happy, even. She seemed to have adjusted to her transformation. That might not have been true for the rest of the family. The typed report was a list of known whereabouts over the last year. Katrina DeBoss had cashed out a savings account to buy a plane ticket to London. From there, she'd wandered, vanishing for weeks before reappearing in some other European city. She seemed to be doing the itinerant backpacking pilgrimage. Any college student might drop out to travel for a few months, but the DeBoss girl seemed to have adopted this as a lifestyle. She was studying art in school, Kramer said. Her parents understand her wanting to go to Europe, but like this? They could have helped her, but she hasn't spoken to them in months. Joanne knew this wasn't the whole story, from watching this scenario play out in dozens of other families. Well-off families suddenly finding a joker in their midst, a puzzle piece that didn't fit into their neat little world, and their first instinct was to bury the problem. That was some people's definition of help.
Joanne wondered if Katrina's parents had proposed amputation and plastic surgery, thinking that half a body would be better than a deformed one. Nobody could blame Katrina for running away from that, except maybe someone like Kramer. She shouldn't be making blanket assumptions about Kramer, the DeBoss family, or anything else. But she also shouldn't have to deal with this kind of soap opera when her job was protecting the tour. "Ma'am, this isn't really in my purview. You should talk to the embassy. They have staff who would be much more helpful. And if I went to them, this would garner publicity that the family really doesn't need. I'm trying to avoid that, and the family would like to avoid any official inquiries." Which gave the whole incident a patina of suspicion that Joanne didn't like at all. Off the record usually meant cover our ass. What was the family trying to hide? And of course Kramer didn't want to be seen pulling strings for a donor. "She's over 18. The kid can do whatever she wants. We can't force her to go home," Joanne said. "I know that, but I'd like to talk to her, if I can. For Mark and Barbara's sake." The tour would be in Prague for 2 days. Local security would be taking up part of the burden of babysitting the delegates. Because of that, she was supposed to have a little time off during those 2 days. Theoretically, she could take a couple of hours to shake some trees and see if the DeBoss girl fell out. Most likely she wouldn't, and Joanne wouldn't feel too bad about it. "I'll see what I can do, but I can't promise anything." "Thank you," Representative Kramer said, and held out her hand to shake Joanne's. A purely reflexive move, a politician's instinct for graciousness. Joanne kept her hands folded underneath her cloak and pressed her lips in apology. She did not shake hands, not even with gloves on. Even that brought her too close to people. Kramer withdrew, wringing her hands awkwardly, and Joanne showed herself out. The next morning, rather than repeating someone else's footwork, Joanne tapped sources at the U.S. Embassy. The intelligence people here weren't idiots. They tracked American citizens entering and leaving the country, especially ones who might raise security flags. Katrina DeBoss wouldn't necessarily raise any flags, but if Kramer was right, she might be running with a crowd that would. Besides, any joker would stand out in this part of the world. She didn't have to explain herself. Her search would stay off the record as Kramer requested. Though Joanne was tempted to get the whole thing on the record just to see what kind of skeletons turned up. That kind of thing was part of her job description. But she'd wait to see what happened before she went that far. In short order, she got what she needed. A starting point. The embassy clerk was able to give her a list of places where disaffected college students and bohemian artist types gathered. Literally bohemian in this part of the world. The original bohemians. She wondered if they even noticed that around here. List in hand, she went for a walk. If she was going to be searching anyway, she might as well enjoy herself by playing tourist. So she wandered along the streets, admiring architecture and stopping at corners to stare at everything from the Art Nouveau splendor of the 19th century opera house to the wicked-looking angled spires of the medieval Tyne Church. Wenceslas Square at one end of a broad, tree-lined street that would have been at home in any city in Western Europe, with yet another impressive 19th century block of buildings and a grand equestrian statue. And even after World War II and 40 years under communism, the city had a Jewish neighborhood and an intact medieval synagogue with a distinctive jagged roofline. There, she'd found an eager tour guide who spoke English and insisted that Rabbi Lowe's famous golem was stored in the roof. Joanne smiled at the story and tipped the guide well. Turning a corner at the edge of the old town, she stumbled across a facade painted with a mural of a gorgeous woman with streaming, curling red hair, a diaphanous gown surrounded by whorls and lilies. Alphonse Mucha. This was an Alphonse Mucha piece, forming a painted arc over a doorway, stuck out here randomly in the middle of the city, obscured by soot, but still clearly Mucha. She just stared for a moment. What an odd, incongruous city. Her dad would love this. Joanne took the time to send a postcard to her father of the Charles Bridge over the river. She'd managed to send him one from almost every city the tour had visited. He should have quite the collection by now. Pictures of beaches and monuments, sunsets and Ayers Rock and the Pyramids of Giza, the Tokyo skyline, the Casa Rosada in Buenos Aires. Maybe when she had some time off, they could take a trip together. She'd suggest it to him. The list of gathering places for the city's disaffected youth was about what she expected. Bars, coffee shops, the basement of a used bookstore, all with a vaguely clandestine air about them. Even behind the Iron Curtain, some things didn't change, and very little could stop young people from gathering to drink and talk about how they were going to change the world. Even if, in a city like this, in a country like this, they might speak very quietly and look over their shoulders while doing so. People stared at her wherever she went, whether it was because she was black or because with her height and rippling cloak, she always drew the eye. She stood out in New York City for crying out loud. She was used to it. It also meant that people rarely messed with her. With the dark surface of her cloak facing out, she could contain her energy, make herself almost a shadow, keep from causing too much of a disturbance when she peeked into coffee houses and scanned for jokers, artists, or anyone who looked like they might know Katrina. She found the place at dusk. The sixth address on her list, it looked like a normal storefront on a back street on the fringes of the old town. A short set of stairs led down to a sunken door, a cellar underneath a square stone building. As she hung back and watched, a pair of young women with short hair and worn jeans pushed through the door and left, arm in arm, giggling and conversing softly in Czech. The door wasn't locked. No secret passwords, no guards. It was hidden in plain sight, the kind of place most people would just walk right by unless they knew it was here. Quickly, she slipped inside. Wrapped in her cloak, she tried to be unobtrusive, keeping to shadows. When a bleary-eyed kid with an ash-laden cigarette stumbled toward her and to the door, she stepped out of his way, and he never took a second glance. Continuing down the stairs, she emerged into a wide room and the bustle of a nascent counterculture. Bare bulbs on sockets, strung together with extension cords, cast a stark light over the scene. The place was set up like some kind of coffee house come workshop. Small groups gathered at tables that were little more than plywood set on sawhorses. The air smelled of thick brewed coffee and strong beer. Conversation rumbled. A black-haired, denim-jacketed girl played guitar and sang earnestly, if a little out of tune. Flyers, posters, and even spray paint decorated the walls, advertising British punk bands and anti-communist revolution. Nobody here could have been over 25, and they were all dressed in ripped jeans, t-shirts, army surplus, gypsy skirts, and faded tunics, all of it thrift store chic. An anticipatory energy ran through the place, people leaning over their work, exchanging excited words. These kids were like something out of Hair, 20 years too late. And they were in a basement that might have been built 600 years ago, pale walls and vaulted ceilings, a chill of age and stone pressing close. Those medieval stone walls now pasted over with slogans and graffiti. She could have wept. But time didn't stand still, did it? This was a city, not a museum. She spotted the American Joker in the back of the hall, leaning over a table and drawing on a wide piece of butcher paper. Joanne had actually missed her on the first scan of the room. Her left side was turned toward the wall, and from this angle she looked a little like Mucha's nymph, long hair curling down her back, bright eyes and fine features. She was missing the draping clothing, instead wearing a shawl over a green army jacket, paisley dress, stockings, and Doc Martens. Holding back a moment, Joanne just watched. Katrina wasn't the only joker in the room. Joanne spotted three others, one with damp and mottled skin like a salamander, another with an extra set of elongated, boneless arms tucked in the pockets of a sleeveless jacket, a third with bright blue hair that might have been dyed, until Joanne saw it moving on its own, like seaweed in a current.
The Jokers didn't cluster together, but were scattered throughout the room, working on projects of their own. There weren't enough of them to form their own clique, their own community. Strangely enough, discrimination wasn't as pronounced when the minority became so small as to not cause anxiety. Joanne had experienced the phenomenon often enough. Katrina was here because she could be an artist here, not just a joker. She looked fine, mostly healthy, smiling. She could stand to eat a little more, maybe. As Joanne watched, patterns in the group's behavior emerged. Different clusters of people appeared to be involved in their own projects and conversations, but on further observation, all the projects had a sameness to them. Signs, banners, streamers, noisemakers. All obvious props for some kind of demonstration. Joanne's heart sank, thinking how these kids were setting themselves up for a confrontation with the Czech police, maybe even Soviet occupation forces. And that sort of thing never ended well. A lanky guy with spiked hair and gaunt features that would have been handsomely rugged if he put on a little weight seemed to be the constant. The one who circled the room, checking in on the various clusters of kids, offering direction on their work. He wore a faded t-shirt for an obscure band and ratty jeans, and he moved with authority, talking to people, nodding in approval or shaking his head, and everyone in the little artist colony looked on him with awe. So, this was most likely the personality in chief around here. When the guy reached Katrina, he wrapped a possessive arm around her, pulled her close, and kissed her. She laughed. When she tried to pull away to get back to her drawing, he didn't let go. They spoke a few words. The guy spoke English with a German accent. Joanne waited until he finished holding court and departed for another circuit of the room before sidling over to catch the young woman's attention. "Katrina DeBoss?" Joanne said gently. The young woman's eyes went round, stricken with guilt, and she pressed herself to the wall. "How do you know who I am?" "I'm Joanne Jefferson. Are you familiar with Congresswoman Carol Kramer? She's a friend of your parents?" "Are you a cop?" she asked. "Or a PI or something?" "Sort of. How much worse would it be to say she was a federal agent?" "Not really," she answered. "Not here, at least. I'm just doing a favor for Representative Kramer, who's here as a delegate on a UN tour and asked me to look in on you. Do you know her? She'd like to talk to you." Relaxing, Katrina smirked. Yeah, I know her. My folks used to drag me to her fundraising dinners. I've never seen a more pretentious group of predators. You can tell her I'm fine. I don't want to talk to her."
"I understand that," Joanne said, "and I can't say that I blame you. But I think your family's worried about you. Do you have a message? Anything you'd like to tell them?"
"They're not really worried about me, you know. It's just that they haven't been able to come up with a good story to tell their friends about what happened to me."
The snakes at her side seemed agitated, twisting and writhing until they curled around her front like a shield. The gesture was very like she'd crossed her arms. "All right. I'll let Kramer know you're okay." From across the room, the German punk kid was staring at them. Katrina quickly looked away.
"You'd better get going," she told Joanne. "You don't really fit in here, you know. You're making people nervous."
Joanne just smiled.
"I get that a lot.
So, can you give me a hint about what you're all doing here?" The Joker glared. "What, you think I'm going to spy for you?"
"I'm just curious. I'd hate to see you all get in trouble."
"You mean more trouble than I'm already in, with my parents' friends sending people like you after me?"
"There's trouble, then there's trouble," Joanne said.
"Just careful. Don't get in over your head if you can help it. I don't know exactly when or where you're going to launch the protest you all are obviously putting together, but you might think twice about putting yourself in the middle of that."
"Thanks for your concern," Katrina shot back, full of sarcasm and contempt.
She wasn't a kid, Joanne reminded herself. She should give the young woman some credit. Katrina picked up two pieces of charcoal, one with her normal hand and one with a snake limb, which curled around it and wielded it like a sword. She bent over the paper and used both pieces to add marks, swoops and whirls and lines that built into a picture. Katrina's work was beautiful. With just the one color, she'd created a shaded series of images on the paper, a cobbled street turning into a rain of flowers that in turn transformed into a woman's curling hair, and the woman's strong face was upturned, determined. Someone else had been wandering the streets and looking at Mujer's art. It's nice, Joanne said inadequately. Katrina flashed a smile that managed to express both gratitude and sarcasm. Hello, I'm Eric. The young German man returned, putting his arm protectively around Katrina and glaring at Joanne, who tried very hard not to smile with amusement. And you are? I'm Joanne, she answered calmly. You've got quite a community here, Eric. I wish you all the best. And what do you want here? I'm just a tourist, passing through and admiring Katrina's work. She didn't expect anything different than the look of stark disbelief he gave her. I'll let you alone. You all have a good evening. After nodding to them both, she slipped out of the basement and back to the street. Joanne was followed most of the way back to the embassy, which didn't surprise her at all. Probably the spooks Ray had spotted staking out the hotel. Tour security had spent enough time warning the delegates that they would likely all be trailed by some kind of foreign intelligence agents if they went into the city. She didn't expect herself to be any different. At night, in the dark, they were easy to spot, mostly because foot traffic had thinned. There were two of them a couple of blocks behind her, one on each side of the street. The one on her side of the street was average height, with close-cropped dark hair atop an angular head. He wore a suit and brown leather jacket and appeared to be looking for an address, checking a card in his hand with street markers posted on building corners and signs above shop fronts. Since he'd been doing this for the past 10 blocks, she didn't quite believe his attempts to find a particular address. Not to mention the fact that every 5 minutes or so, he glanced across the street to his partner. This second man was large, half a head taller than the people he passed on the sidewalk. This was the only clear detail about him. He wore a long overcoat, the collar turned up, hands hidden in the pockets, and walked with his shoulders hunched to his ears. His steps were steady, but slow. He moved like a man walking through a storm, though the sky was clear, the air cool, but not uncomfortable. She might have overlooked him as simply an old man lost in thought during an evening walk, except that the smaller man in the leather coat kept looking at him, and the large man would occasionally nod back. No matter how the medieval streets of the old part of the city twisted and jogged, turning abruptly and merging into squares before breaking off again at an odd angle, they kept on her. This was their city, after all. She pegged them as local, not KGB. Through the old town and along the main tourist drag back to the hotel, few lights illuminated the streets, but those few were enough. Joanne pushed her cloak back over her shoulder and raised a hand as if feeling the air for new rainfall. She focused on the lights and breathed in. Two street lights, one ahead of her and one behind her, sparked and went dark. A faint tracery of light followed her hand, the sign that the electricity was now part of her. She felt it hum along her skin, warming her flesh and even her bones. Almost pleasant if she didn't have to worry so much about what happened after. She was a human capacitor, a burst of lightning contained, wrapped in an insulating cloak to keep it all from roiling out, right until the moment she wanted it to. She'd left the cobbled medieval streets and now walked along modern asphalt, with a modern steel drain grating on the far corner between her and the agents who trailed her. This she targeted, sweeping back her cloak and flicking out her arm, sending a bolt of power arcing to the metal. A crack like thunder echoed, and sparks rained. Joanne turned the corner, using the explosion to distract from her exit. Her bolt of lightning shouldn't have done too much damage. Scorched the asphalt, maybe, but it sure looked exciting. Let them try to figure that out. They didn't think they could follow her all the way back to the hotel unscathed, did they? A couple of blocks later, she ducked into a doorway to take a look. And sure enough, she seemed to have lost them. She brushed her hands together in a show of satisfaction. Back at the hotel, Joanne had maybe an hour to relax and get some sleep before going back on duty. Billy Ray caught her in the hotel lobby on her way in. Likely, he'd been watching for her.
Have a nice walk?
Ray asked, raising an eyebrow, leering, or that might have been just the odd shape of his mouth and jaw.
I did indeed. I had company most of the way. A couple of our friends from across the street, I'm guessing. They give you any trouble?
Nope, not even a little. He didn't need to know that she might have been a little excessive in her effort to lose them.
I know, you're perfectly capable of taking care of yourself. Don't remind me.
She pulled off her hood, exposing her head, her close-cropped dark hair, her smile. She felt a static charge tickling across her cheeks and scalp, the ambient energy in the room calling to her from the wiring, the light bulbs, and even from Ray's beating heart. She'd have to put the hood back up in a minute before the hum turned into an itching, then a burning. She'd suck power in, then launch it back out in a blast that she couldn't control.
Ray, you're just itching to have a go at taking care of me, aren't you?
He grinned.
You flirt harder than anyone I know, hon.
Is that what this is? He took a step toward her. A dangerous step. Energy poured off him, his ace-fueled strength flowing, and all she had to do was reach out and touch that craggy cheek. He knew it, too. For all the grin in his lips, his gaze was clouded, maybe just a little bit afraid.
One of these days I'm going to try it, just to see what happens,
he said, when he was just a hand span away from her. All she'd have to do was lean forward to kiss him. You know where to find me, she said, putting her hood up as she slipped around him and walked away. Behind her, he chuckled. Joanne never remembered a time when her touch did not kill. Her first victim had been her own mother. That time was a blur, thankfully. The accident, the fear, the days of trying to figure out what had happened and realizing that it was all her fault. Sequestered in the hospital, her father holding her while she cried. He wore a hazmat suit to prevent the least stray contact until the doctors could figure out the exact nature of her murderous ace. Thick rubber, slippery plastic, and hissing gas mask between them. He could hold her, but not touch her. She would never feel a gentle skin-to-skin touch of kindness again. He couldn't kiss her to make it better. She spent a lot of time thinking about how different her life would have been if her father hadn't stayed with her. If he'd blamed her instead of forgiving her. Rejected her and her freakish powers instead of embracing her. Metaphorically, at least. On the day she wanted to wail and break windows and rip off her own flesh, he was there to talk her down. Would she have been able to live with herself if he hadn't been there to reassure her that this would all be worthwhile someday? This power of yours, of course, it's dangerous. It can be destructive if you aren't careful. But so can electricity, knives, cars, and these are tools we need. Joanne, you have to figure out a way to make this thing good. Use it to build things up instead of break things down. Because of her father, she'd gone into government service instead of to an institution. Most days, she knew she'd taken the right path. She chose her ace name, Lady Black, herself, and it had many levels of meaning. It was the color of the absorbing side of her cloak and the color of her skin. It represented the danger of her dark power. The title, The Lady, reminded people to treat her with respect. The delegates had meetings and tours all the next day. This was another stop where the stated mission of the tour on paper and in reality didn't quite match up. Ostensibly, the delegates were meant to observe with impartial interest an Eastern Bloc communist government's innovations in treating the wildcard virus and report on conditions experienced by victims of the virus. In reality, they were treated to another dog and pony show of sparkling clean institutions and carefully staged interviews with hand-picked and coached jokers, and even a few aces in controlled settings. Czech officials presented a middle-aged man who could telekinetically rearrange the print in any book to read as the Communist Manifesto. Ideologically impressive, no doubt, however questionable the ace's actual usefulness was. The American delegates were polite enough not to ask how many of Czechoslovakia's more powerful aces were working for intelligence agencies or had been recruited by the KGB. And the Czech guides were polite enough not to offer the information. Joanne's excursion in town last night illustrated that at least some of the country's virus victims went unnoticed by the system. The country didn't sequester all its jokers, which made it marginally better than some, she supposed. In her role as bodyguard and babysitter, Joanne accompanied one of the tours, mostly made up of the American politicians and WHO officials rather than the celebrities, who were off with Billy Ray playing the photogenic tourist in the old town. After so many weeks of this sort of a thing, the routine was established. Dr. Tachyon grilled the rather stunned local medical professionals, who stammered answers in rough English or sometimes French, or spoke through interpreters. The politicians looked on, feigning interest through glazed expressions. Kramer was here, but Joanne hadn't had a chance to speak with her about Katrina. That came after hours, while most of the other delegates were sipping afternoon drinks in the hotel bar, and the congresswoman once again invited Joanne to the front room of her suite. I found her, Joanne said, and Kramer let out a sigh. She's not interested in coming home, or even talking about it, really. Is she all right? She's not in trouble, is she? She was sitting at the edge of a straight-back chair with scrolled detail pulled out from a breakfast table. That depended on how you define trouble. I think she's all right, Joanne said, carefully neutral. But like I said, she's an adult. If she doesn't want to talk, we can't make her. She hoped this would be the end of it. Do you think... I would like to talk to her, Lady Black. You know where she is. Can you arrange a meeting? Not only was this way outside Joanne's normal responsibilities, Kramer was bordering on using her position to gain special consideration, a minor abuse of power practiced by politicians from time immemorial, but still an abuse, if Joanne chose to call her on it. She didn't want to go hunting down the wayward artist again. Miss Dubois was certain. Her family is worried about her. You must understand that. If I can talk to her myself, at least then I'll be able to give her parents first-hand information about her. That can't be so difficult, can it? I'll see what I can do. The formal embassy reception was tonight. She really didn't have time. But truth be told, she was curious herself. Another trip to the city center. Maybe she'd get a hint about what the kids were up to with their protest plans. When she arrived at the curved alley with the basement art commune, the place was blocked off with police cars, roof lights flashing. A couple of uniformed cops loitered, looking bored. More cops were passing in and out through the basement doorway, carrying posters torn from the wall, stacks of paper, and even buckets of paint and art supplies. They took their haul to a short moving truck parked at the other end of the alley, tossed everything in, unmindful of how it landed. If she asked, she was certain they'd tell her they were collecting evidence, no matter how haphazard the process looked from the outside. These guys were standard law enforcement, not scary Secret Service or the like. From her vantage, lingering at the corner to watch the proceedings, eavesdropping on conversations in a language she didn't understand, she couldn't guess what crime they were investigating, if that even mattered. They'd found the artist's space, and they'd shut it down. In New York, a crowd of onlookers would have gathered at both end of the alleys, elbowing each other and pressing forward for a better look, and half a dozen cops and barriers would be on hand just to keep back the public. Here, no one. Passers-by pointedly walked on, heads bowed and gaze averted. Lingering at a scene like this drew unwanted attention. Joanne took the hint and left. She kept an eye out for her friends, the two agents who'd tailed her yesterday. She had a sinking feeling they might have been the ones to put the cops onto the basement hideout, after she'd shown them the way there. They didn't seem to be around for the moment, but then they didn't need to be. At the next intersection, a figure reached out and an orange bundle of tentacles twined around her arm. At the first hint of a touch, Joanne leapt backward, getting herself out of reach and wrapping her insulating cloak more firmly around her. Katrina DeBoss, wearing a different sweater, shawl, and bohemian peasant skirt today, stood at the corner, smirking. "Do I really gross you out that much?" she said. "My touch kills," Joanne said. "You could have died if you'd gotten skin." The girl paled. And yes, Joanne got that reaction a lot. Almost worse than the lack of touch was having to explain it to people, and the look of pity they donned when they understood the implications. "You're an ace?" Katrina asked. She squinted, peering for a glimpse under Joanne's hood. "Ace or Joker?" That was a philosophical question for the ages, wasn't it? The way some people recoiled from Joanne in fear, she might very well be a Joker, no matter what she saw when she looked in the mirror. "Let's walk, Katrina." Joanne gestured ahead, and she and Katrina continued on, side by side. The Joker kept a healthy distance between them. Joanne was about to start the difficult conversation when Katrina asked, "Is it worth it? Being an ace, if that's the price you have to pay for it." Nobody had ever put it to her in such blunt terms, but the question was elegant. Elegant and unanswerable. No one had given her the option of paying a price for her ace. Both the power and the price had landed randomly. "To tell you the truth, I don't always think of myself as an ace. I'm just doing the best I can with what I have." "Yeah, me too," she said. A few more steps and Joanne asked, "Did everyone get out okay?" "Oh yeah, we saw them coming. No thanks to you." Even if Joanne hadn't led the police to their basement, the kids were going to blame her for it. So be it, especially if it kept them from embarking on any potentially dangerous protest plans. "Representative Kramer wants to meet you in person. You think you can take a few minutes for her? There's a cafe near the hotel where you two should be able to get together without drawing too much attention." "I don't want to talk to her. She's just trying to pander to my parents." Couldn't fault the kid for being perceptive. Joanne tipped her head in acknowledgement. Katrina said, "Why are you even working for Kramer? I looked you up, and the WHO tour. This seems way outside your job description." "I was curious. You and your friends are obviously planning something. Or you were." "Still are. This isn't going to stop us. We got out everything we needed, and they can't stop us. We can go tonight if we want." Something about the look in her eye, the way she smiled, made Joanne think this wasn't hypothetical. "What exactly are you planning?" Joanne asked. "You'll have to read about it in the papers tomorrow." "This isn't a game, Katrina. If these guys arrest you for doing something they don't like, you'll be in for a world of hurt. The embassy, your parents, might not be able to bail you out." She grimaced. "Oh, I know. My parents wouldn't lift a finger to help me. The raid was just about intimidation, a scare tactic. It didn't work." She spoke with the chin-up, fist-clenched conviction of youth and righteousness. "Is that what that Eric guy said? Is he putting you up to this? Because a deluded little thing like me couldn't possibly have my own opinions about it?
Or maybe I'm just so grateful that any guy will even look at a twisted-up freak like me that I'd do anything for him.
She held up her arm, and the snakes writhed. Glinting light across the orange scales made her look like she held fire.
I'm not doing this because of Eric, or because I'm crazy, or I'm trying to get back at my parents, or I'm part of a cult or anything. I'm doing this because I want to. Because it's a good thing to do. Because I can help. I can use my trust fund money for something good instead of just going on fancy, useless shopping sprees or whatever. Because Prague is beautiful, and Mucha and Dvorak and Kafka lived here. And because as stupid as it may look from the outside, protests like this are working. They're going to work. And it doesn't hurt to dream, does it?
Joanne lowered her gaze. Oh, to be young and full of convictions. Katrina, be careful. I'll be in Prague for another day. If you get in trouble or need help, contact me.
I'll be fine. Tell Kramer I'm fine.
With a flounce of her skirt, Katrina turned and stomped off, her tentacled arm curled protectively around her middle. Joanne didn't get back to the hotel until dusk, and Ray met her at the door.
You're late,
he said, glaring.
We're due at the embassy in half an hour.
That's right, she said, shouldering past him. Did anything happen while I was gone that you couldn't handle on your own?
Well, no.
Then I'm back. I'm on duty, and I don't want to hear any more about it.
Are you getting into some kind of trouble out there?
She looked up enough so he could see her expression under her hood and raised a smug brow at him.
I said I didn't want to hear it. Do you trust me or not?
He frowned.
I don't not trust you, but you're kind of weird, you know?
Coming from Billy Ray, that was almost a compliment. Agent Ray, I am an ace, which makes me exactly as weird as you are. Now, don't you think we should round up the delegates and get a move on? He gestured grandly into the lobby.
Lead on, princess.
The U.S. Embassy in Prague was an honest-to-God 17th-century palace with courtyards, wings, Baroque moldings, cavernous ceilings, and some 100 rooms. Even Dr. Tachyon seemed impressed as the group traveled up the garden walk through arched doorways into the formal reception hall. Human beings so rarely lived up to his standards. Embassy receptions, Joanne had learned, all looked pretty much the same. The ambassador and spouse would be gracious hosts, and their staff would be preternaturally adept at smoothing over difficulties, faux pas, and other mishaps before they became international incidents. The food, drink, and music would be excellent. Some national specialty would be prominently featured. Tango in Argentina, sashimi in Japan, and so on. There might or might not be alcohol in an Islamic country, but there'd likely be something to make up for it if it was absent. Amazing coffee, for example. But this was Eastern Europe. There was plenty of alcohol. It was all like watching a movie from Joanne's perspective. The same movie with this crowd. Dr. Tachyon downing champagne glassfuls at a time. Hiram Worcester had returned to the tour, at least for the moment, and was holding forth over a tray of hors d'oeuvres. The politicians circulated, shaking hands and conversing. Joanne spotted Representative Kramer in a conservative, high-necked gown that seemed more like a dress suit with a long skirt than formal wear. Xavier Desmond, who might insist that he wasn't a politician, was part of the circulating group. Chrysalis, however, was not. Wearing a purple strapless gown that seemed to draw attention to the shifting contours of her visible musculature, she sat on the periphery, watching closely. One change from the start of the tour. Peregrine was no longer modeling svelte, haute couture gowns at every event. She still managed to look gorgeous in shimmering maternity wear that draped artfully around her expanding middle. All this, taking place in the embassy's finely curtained and carpeted reception hall, made for a strange gathering. Both political, public, sensational, serious. As usual, Joanne remained outside it, lurking in her cloak and hood, observing, and nothing more. When Kramer detached herself from her conversation and came across the hall toward her, Joanne's stomach sank. What now? It couldn't possibly be important enough to interrupt the reception for. For someone who wanted to avoid attention, Kramer was certainly drawing a lot of it to her now. Joanne straightened and reminded herself to be professional. No ducking around the corner to escape from this. Lady Black. Agent Jefferson. May I speak with you? Joanne had to keep her sigh to herself. Why don't we step outside, Representative Kramer? The ace led her through a side hall to a secluded corner of the patio where the light and eavesdroppers didn't reach. Kramer was impatient when she demanded, "Were you able to arrange a meeting with Katrina?" "No, Representative Kramer. Ms. DeBoss doesn't seem to want to have anything to do with her family."
"She said you were pandering," Joanne kept to herself.
"She's wise," Kramer said, and her expression changed, wincing into something like pain. Joanne raised a polite eyebrow, inquiring. The woman started pacing along the edges of the marble patio. "I spoke on the phone with Katrina's parents this afternoon. I'm afraid I've been under a bit of a misapprehension. When they asked me to contact her, I believed they wanted her to come home. I assumed, you see, if she were my daughter, I'd want her to come home." "What was it they really wanted?" Joanne prompted gently. "It had to be bad," the way she took a deep breath before launching in. "They want evidence that she's broken the terms of her trust so they can disinherit her. If she ever gets arrested, if she's ever convicted of anything more than a parking ticket, she loses her trust fund. And mind you, this isn't because she ran away. This isn't because she's done anything wrong. It's simply because of her condition. It's terribly unjust. So you see, Katrina's wise to distance herself. She's their daughter. They should be taking care of her." The world of trust funds and disinherited children was far outside Joanne's experience, but Kramer's consternation was plain. Family was clearly more important than the wild card virus or any other consideration. That, Joanne understood. She also understood. Katrina was, right now as they spoke, getting herself into exactly the kind of trouble that would get her disinherited. Kramer would want to know, though it was probably better that she didn't. Katrina would want to know. Surely she'd want to stay out of trouble if it meant keeping her trust fund and pissing off her parents to boot. Now, if only Joanne knew exactly where Katrina was and what she was doing. Kramer went on. "I only want to offer her help. She can't go to her family if she gets in trouble, obviously, but I'd like her to have some recourse. We get into politics because we think we can fix all the world's problems, that we really can make a difference. I knew it would be hard, but look at this tour. What good are we doing, really? But I thought I could at least help this one person." Joanne was hardly listening, because this wasn't about Kramer anymore. She decided. She had to get out, find Katrina, and keep the police off her back. The rest could wait. "I'll try to talk to her one more time," she told the congresswoman. "I very much appreciate your help, Agent Jefferson." That was nice, but at this point Joanne was mostly worried about whether Katrina would appreciate it. She looked around the reception hall and the party that was in full swing. The delegates could not be any more secure than they were here, in the middle of the U.S. Embassy. They could spare her for a couple of hours. Billy Ray made an impressive show of force all by himself, planted at the arched entrance between the reception hall and the gardens. He wore his white fighting suit and stood, arms crossed and scowling, studying everyone who entered or left. She sidled up to him, swirling her cloak behind her, and spoke over his shoulder. Billy, can you cover for me?
Why? What's up?
This is a personal favor for one of the delegates that has gotten way out of hand, but I'm in it now, so I have to finish it.
Hun, you are not making any sense at all. What's wrong?
Urging him outside to the shelter of an obliging shrub, she told him the whole story.
Huh. Great,
he said, lip curling.
You know you don't owe these people anything, right? Not Kramer, not the rich kid.
This isn't about Kramer anymore. That's the whole point, Joanne said, sighing, and looking out over the city as if she expected to see fireworks launching up from their planned protest. The river shone like liquid lead under the city's nighttime lights, and the spires of the Tyne Church rose up like a demonic scepter. Back in the 60s, a couple of students here set themselves on fire to protest Soviet occupation of the country. That's what I'm afraid she's gotten herself into.
Because here was a kid whose life had been turned upside down by the wildcard virus, but she was determined to move on, to find meaning, to do something great in the world.
Joanne understood.
And if that's what she's determined to do, how are you going to stop her?
I just want to find her and talk to her.
Then I'll help.
Really, that's not necessary. You don't...
Seriously. Sounds like more fun than this show.
Indeed. A tipsy Tachyon had just accosted the pianist who'd been providing background music and was imploring him to sing Mozart. Ray leered.
Besides, you need someone watching your back.
What harm could he do?
Ha!
Together they snuck out of the reception. He touched her shoulder and urged her on, down the sidewalk to the embassy delivery gate. Didn't even think about it. The gesture had been as natural as shading one's eyes from the sun. The fabric of her cloak protected him, and her. So close and yet so far, she thought for the millionth time. A spring rain shower had fallen that afternoon, giving the streets a slick sheen, giving a fresh chill to the air. The hem of her cloak grew damp as it brushed on the pavement. When Joanne thought about it, their destination was obvious. Wenceslas Square. The broad thoroughfare had been the site of political gatherings and demonstrations for decades. If Katrina and Eric's bunch was planning something, something they wanted to garner a lot of attention, they would go there. She and Ray set off on foot, planning to find a cab once they got off the embassy grounds. But of course, this late and in this part of town, taxis were scarce. The central part of the city wasn't that big, so they kept moving, across the river and into the old town. Where Ray was immediately tackled by an immense figure in a long coat. Her tale from yesterday. The big man had grabbed the ace around the middle at a dead run and kept going, carrying him off the sidewalk and across the street. Joanne put her back to the wall of the nearest building and looked around for the guy's partner. Spotted him across the street, waiting. The big guy kept going, smashing Ray into the wall, cracking the brick in all directions. Ray slumped, dazed, but kept to his feet and threw a punch that landed on the guy's gut with a dull thud before the guy picked him up and smashed him into the wall again. They must have known about Ray's ace, and that they'd have to do a lot of smashing before they'd drop him. They seemed intent on doing exactly that. Joanne couldn't let that happen. She ran, shifting her cloak over her shoulders and reaching out for the tough guy. His partner, the smaller man, didn't do anything, which made Joanne suspicious. What was he waiting for? Or more likely, what was he hiding? Keeping an eye on the partner, standing watchfully half a block away, Joanne slapped her hand on the large one's back and pulled, opening the doors to her power. The feeling was like a vortex in the middle of her gut, a yawning hole that was desperate for power,
that would swallow the energy and keep going until her whole being exploded. She had it all planned out. Drop him like a rock by sucking him close to dry, then turning and punching a big chunk of his own energy back into him. He'd be off his feet for weeks, if not dead outright. But nothing happened. She had a firm grip on him, but nothing poured out of him, and she didn't feel so much as a spark. It was like he was dead already, but somehow still upright, still moving. He turned around to stare at her with a stone-like gaze. Then, with surprising deftness, the big guy grabbed her and hoisted her off the ground. Still no effect. She tried the reverse, grabbing his shoulders with both her bare hands to slam a bomb's worth of energy into him. Power bounced off in a cascade of lightning, and he continued holding tight to her. Now she struggled, kicking and digging fingernails into strangely unyielding flesh. He was solid, his muscles hard, and his expression vaguely bland as he started squeezing. Here was someone who could touch her. He was touching her, and not falling, not dying. She could touch this man. He could touch her, and not die. The fact thrilled her. Even as he was obviously trying to kill her, she almost leaned in to kiss him. Proposition. For every ace power, there existed, somewhere, an equal and opposite power. Every ace had an opposite, against whom their power was useless. The idea offered a strangely comforting balance to the universe. If she could drain the life force from anyone, didn't it stand to reason there was an ace, somewhere, whose power meant his life force couldn't be drained? Of course, Murphy's Law intruded. A man who could touch her, and he was trying to kill her. Her arms were pinned. She kicked at his knees and groin, but he didn't even flinch. All she did was stub her toes on his rock-solid flesh. Joanne's big professional secret was that she wasn't at all proficient in martial arts and hand-to-hand combat skills that would usually be required for a federal agent working security. She could learn movements, but she couldn't realistically spar with anyone without running the risk of killing them with her power. When she could incapacitate anyone with just a wave of her hand, no one ever thought she needed proficiency in hand-to-hand combat. Well, so much for that. Caught in the powerful ace's grip, she could do little more than flop while he squeezed harder. Her ribs creaked, and she choked on a breath when her lungs refused to expand.